You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today we are doing something that we have not done in a while. It's going to be a really special show because I am doing an interview with a singer named Doug Shorts. Can you say hi?
Hey, what's going on?
So Doug was in a group called The Master Plan that played around Chicago in the 70s and cut one obscure record, but
a couple of them.
Oh, you cut a couple records?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah, you cut a solo record also.
I cut two. One with the band and one. It was also with the band, but yeah. And then, it was a cassette.
Oh, yeah. I'm so focused on vinyl that I'm...
Right, okay, yeah, we did two vinyl singles, though.
But it's going to be a really interesting interview because Doug has a lot of history in Chicago and had a lot of connections. And also we have some excellent unreleased material and your new material, so you should definitely keep tuned. And the records you did release were very good also, so they just didn't get distributed very
right.
well. So, first of all, I always like to ask people, are you originally from Chicago?
Born and raised, Cook County Hospital.
And what part of Chicago are you from?
The near north side.
Okay.
Adjacent to Cabrini Green, between the Gold Coast and Cabrini Green.
Okay. So Cabrini Green is kind of legendary for all the north side groups coming out of there.
Yeah.
Like Curtis Mayfield.
Curtis, Major Lance, Jerry Butler, Billy Butler.
So when did you first live there?
I was born in Cook County Hospital. I was my first address was on Larrabee Street, about 1013 or something like that, on Larrabee.
Okay.
Yeah, so from in conception all the way.
Okay.
Yeah. So when they first built Cabrini, I think about they built it in maybe 53, 54 or something. I lived there in 57.
Okay.
It was still practically new.
So did you know Curtis or Major?
No, I knew Major. I didn't know Curtis. Curtis went to school with my uncle, as well as Jerry Butler went to school with another uncle. Major went to school with my uncles, but I happened to eventually meet Major, though. He was more my era than he was theirs.
What school was that?
Wells High.
Okay. So how did you first get involved with music?
My uncles had like a barbershop quartet, but they used to sing all the time at home, and I always wanted to get involved, and they wouldn't let me. So it kind of stoked the fire in me to want to sing, you know.
Okay, so they were always singing harmony.
Yeah, beautiful harmony, man.
And so when did you first start singing?
Probably in high school, about my second year of high school, I started a group with some friends, some high school friends.
And that was in the 60s sometime?
Yeah, probably about 67, probably about my third year of high school, yeah.
Okay, so what was your group called?
The Mannequins.
And was that the first time you were really singing in harmony with other people?
Yeah, actually, the guys in the neighborhood, we sang together, but they weren't really up to speed to be in a group. So when I got to high school, I found a couple of polish guys like Racine Bailey. He was a member of the same church I went to, and he played keyboard, and he had great harmony. So we pretty much were the nucleus of the group. Then we met Lawrence Calvin while at school. He was from the west side. He hooked up with us.
How did you meet him?
At school, just in the cafeteria or something, you know. He was just a live guy, and we kind of liked him and hooked
so
up.
He was from the west side, but he went to Wells?
Yeah, he went to Wells, yeah.
Okay.
And he wanted to sing. He was a ladies' man. He was like a chick magnet, so we brought him into the group to pull chicks in, you know.
Okay. And then was that three members you just named?
Yeah, and then we got Lucius Dobbs. He was a real solid dancer. He made up the group. Between Lawrence, Racine, and myself, Lucius taught us dance steps, and we kind of got together. And then Lucius had a friend, Otha Alexander, brought him in. So we had like a five-piece group, so we were imitated to Temptations.
Okay. So you did a lot of Motown type stuff?
A lot of Motown stuff, yeah.
So I know on the north side at that time, like in Cabrini, there was... like one of the bigger groups was the Admirations.
Yeah, our competition. Yeah.
You got like people on my show always want to hear "Wait Till I Get to Know You."
Yeah, that was a good song. Yeah.
So you knew them and they were your competition.
Yeah, we did a lot of talent shows together a lot before they ever got the record, and then even after they got the record, we still did shows.
Okay, and did you know? I know the players were there.
Yeah, Herb Butler and the Players. Yeah, we knew them too. They were like my uncle's age though; they were older.
And what about Joe Brackenridge and the Cascades?
Yeah, we did some shows with them. We did Battle of the Bands with them when they were the Cascades.
Okay. Yeah. So what
a record like Pain All in My Heart.
Yeah, that was their biggest record.
Yeah, we used to play with them.
So what are some of the other groups that you remember from back in the day that you battled against?
Well, it was a girls group. I don't remember the name, but it was Bertha, Bernice, and what was the other girl? Janet.
Okay.
They're from Cooley High. I don't know the name of that group, but they were the hottest group on the north side. They were our biggest competition, even more so than the Aberrations and the Ambitions. The Ambitions were the other group that was really tough. They patterned after Jerry Butler and Curtis Mayfield.
And that was in the 60s also?
Yeah. We all did talent shows.
But the Ambitions never recorded?
Not that I know of. I never heard them record.
But you were telling me that one of the people...
Yeah, Keith Samuels, he was one of the singers in the group. He eventually moved to Atlanta. I got him a hookup, and he moved to Atlanta and started this group called Ripple. They had a couple hit records.
Yeah, they were a funk group.
Yeah, very funky. Yeah. They had the wine distributor backed them up to Ripple the wine.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, actually. When Keith came back, he brought wine for us. Man. I had a little pouch in the back to drink your wine out of. Yeah, it was cool.
So it was the late 60s, and you were singing. Can you talk a little bit about the shows, like where you performed? And were they all, like, you talk about battling other groups, were they all competitions? Did you open for anybody? Like, what was happening?
Well, yeah, actually, we did get into opening for acts, but right then, it was like the amateur hour. We would do, like, St. Joseph's Basement. You know, there was a school on Orleans Street called St. Joseph's. We did talent shows there. And St. Matthew's, a church, Catholic church, we did talent shows there. And it was competition. It was trying to see who was the best. And let's see. Then my group, we got lucky. We got a particular place we stayed all the time called Poor Richard's. It used to be a folk club.
Okay.
And it closed, and the lady came in from Washington D.C. and got it, turned it into a non-for-profit corporation, and made it our place. It was our home base. We rehearsed there, and we did shows there. So we did shows against the different groups there too. It was one group, the Soul Invaders. They were our competition. They had a guy that did James Brown.
Was it Frankie Newsom and the Soul Invaders?
No. It was Greg White, Sammy Fender's brother, Chuck Taylor, and Willie Townsend did the James Brown. He was the best James Brown impersonator.
Okay.
And that's the only way they could hang with us, because they couldn't handle us otherwise. But that James Brown act kept them in the fray with us.
I think they cut a record, though.
They did?
I think so.
No, I never knew of them cutting a record. But
so how long were the Mannequins together?
Oh, I'd say maybe, let me see, from 67 to about 81. No, 67 to about 71, about 4 years.
So pretty much throughout high school you were together.
Yeah.
So did you ever become a bigger group, an open travel or open for anybody?
We opened after the Mannequins. We kind of went by the wayside, and I kept a band and went and became a single artist. And I picked up a girl singer from Cooley High also. Her name was Carolyn Love, and we did a duet like Marvin and Tammy. So we did a lot of openings. We opened at the High Chaparral for Lou Rawls, the Detroit Emeralds, Denise Lassell, to just name a few.
Okay, but I think we're skipping part of your career. That point. So the Mannequins, did you ever record?
We recorded four sides at this place called International Records over off from Milwaukee Avenue.
Okay.
And we never signed a contract, so it never released.
Why didn't you sign a contract with them?
Because the contract was bogus. You know, my mother had a boyfriend that was a lawyer. He looked at the contract and had a fit. He laughed at it. He said, "No way you're going to sign this."
Okay.
So we just dropped that idea, and we left the songs, but I took those same four songs and went to Brunswick Records and auditioned them there. And Major Lance fell in love with the songs, and he actually acted like he wanted to use them. So I signed the songs away to their publishing at Brunswick, and they never used them. They shelved them. So
that's too bad. You probably would have gotten some money.
Right, probably would have worked, because then I took them across the street to Jerry Butler. He opened up a workshop, and he liked the songs too. But when he found out that Brunswick owned the publishing rights, he wouldn't touch it. So
you're talking about the writer's workshop that he had?
Yeah, I was a member of the writer's workshop.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you actually, did you record at Brunswick, or you were just auditioning for them?
No, we just auditioned for them. But later on when the master plan hooked up, we actually did record at Brunswick.
Okay.
But then we had a problem there with the contract also. We did a verbal thing. We went in on agreement, you know, just a handshake. And after the handshake, by the time we actually started recording, we recorded four sides. And about then, they started slipping producers in on us and other ways to take money from us. And I seen what was going on, and I put a wrench in that machinery and broke it up and stopped the session.
Yeah, and it's good when you were kids. I mean, it's bad that records didn't come out, but it's good that you had somebody protecting you with that contract, because a lot of people
got ripped.
Yeah.
That's why my mom was not having it. You know, she seen that we were trying to do it. She wanted to make sure that we got paid if we played.
Okay.
So I kind of was the devil's advocate all of the time. When the business didn't look right, I spoke up. So I was the bad guy.
Okay. So how did the Mannequins break up?
Well, when the Visitors came on the set, when we auditioned at Brunswick, I met the Visitors. They were a new group from Kansas City. They were recording at Brunswick.
Until You Came Along.
Right. They recorded that song. In fact, I was at the session. As soon as they finished the session, the lead singer quit. And since I did a high tenor, they figured I could step in and take his place. So they hired me to take the lead singer's place, and I went on the road with them.
Was that guy, it was Eugene Smiley, was that?
Yeah, that was his name.
Yeah.
He owned a construction company or something bad, so he wasn't broke. The rest of the guys were broke. They was just had to call at the company's mercy. But he had money, so he went back home and lived comfortably.
And you took his place?
I took his place, yeah.
And you didn't record with them, but you toured with them?
Yeah, I toured with them, yeah, about a couple of months.
So where did you go?
Just to Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas.
Okay.
It was the shortest tour ever.
What happened on the tour?
Well, we played with the group that became Bloodstone, and that was it. That one
day. The Sinceres?
Yeah, Sinceres, yeah. They were part of the Derby Review. And when that played out, we were sitting around Kansas City broke. I'm starving. Yeah. Carl Davis from Brunswick wouldn't send money for everybody. He only sent money for the cats who were under contract. That was only Ray and Daryl. So I had to get back on my own. Ray's girlfriend paid my way back to Chicago.
So, you got lucky.
Yeah, I got lucky. By the time I got back to Chicago, I didn't want anything to do with the Visitors anymore.
So you dropped out?
I quit and started my own group back.
So
I took the band because my group had went by the wayside by then. So I picked up the band that we had, the Crystal Image, and I became a single artist and started working like that.
And we never talked about that. You weren't just a vocal group, but you also had a band as the Mannequins?
Right, yeah, we were self-contained, yeah.
Who were the members of your band?
Okay, the original band was Tony Gaines, what was his brother's name? Butch Gaines, that was the drummer and the rhythm player. The lead guitar player was Joe Stevenson. Bass player was Timothy Jackson, and the drummer was Kenny Walker.
Okay, and did you know them all from high school also?
Yeah, from the neighborhood, actually. They didn't go to the same school.
What was the other school over there?
Waller. That's where all of the hotbed of the activity, all the music was at Waller, really.
So you went to Wells, but like a lot of the other groups went to Waller.
Yeah, everybody else from the neighborhood went to Waller, yeah.
Okay.
We did the talent shows at Waller, too, though.
Okay. Yeah. But where didn't Curtis go to Wells, you were telling
me? Yeah, well, he went. We had the same counselor, in fact.
Okay.
Yeah. When I got ready to quit school, his counselor said, well, just go ahead. Yeah, Curtis did. He did all right.
The counselor encouraged you.
Yeah, he encouraged me to quit school, man.
So
I wasn't doing that great anyway.
But you were telling me earlier you actually quit to be with the Visitors.
Right. I quit to go on the road with them.
So did you think you were going to be a big
success? Yeah, they filled my head with a lot of nonsense. Oh, we big as the Temptations, you know. The girls are going to be all over you. We're going to make lots of money. So it was a no-brainer. I just quit school and went on the road with them.
And then you came back and you
dropped
out of the group.
Yeah, I went back to school. I joined Cooley. I went to Cooley High after that.
Okay.
And basically, Cooley was just, I was just going there to pick up girls. But they did have talent shows, though. So that's when Lucius kind of got into the picture. And we did shows there. We were probably top dog on the north side then.
What was your group there?
It was still the Mannequins.
Oh, so you came back and reformed?
We kind of let the group go by the wayside, and it was just me and the band, and we became Crystal Image.
Okay.
Doug Schwartz and the Crystal Image. Then we picked up Carol and Love, so it was Doug Schwartz and Carol and Love with the Crystal Image.
And I forgot to ask, how did the Mannequins get their name?
I picked that out. I was trying to find a name, and Mannequin came up, but then Mannequin is a dummy. So I wanted something that, that was elegant. So mannequin is a dummy, but a model, but a live model instead of just a dummy. So that's why we picked that name.
And how'd you get the name Crystal Image?
The drummer, Kenny Walker, was in the rock groups, and he heard something like that, and he liked that name, and I liked it, and it stuck.
It sounds like a rock band.
Yeah. He was into rock music, Cream and all of that stuff.
Okay. Yeah. So the Crystal Image formed like 72, something like that?
Let's see. I got it here on my computer. Crystal Image, yes. Well, actually, about 68, 69, I think we picked up the Crystal Image name.
Okay. So you were doing shows at Cooley as the Crystal Image?
Yeah.
How long did the Crystal Image stay together?
Let's see, until about 71.
Okay. And you said that you were the lead and you had incorporated a female singer also?
Yes, Carolyn Love. Yeah, we were doing a duet like Marvin and Tammy.
Okay. So were you known as the What were you known as?
Doug Schultz and Carolyn Love, you know. Nobody probably even knew the name of the band. You know, they just knew it was Doug's band, you know.
So you didn't have like a review or anything? It was just
just the two of us. We came out in front of the band, that's all.
Were you still doing talent shows or
we got professional at that point. We were like the house band at the High Chaparral. We were backing up different people that come to town, like the Detroit Emeralds, Denise LaSalle. Just to name a couple of them that I can remember. Our biggest gig was with Lou Rawls. He had his own band, but we opened for him.
So you would open up for a lot of big...
Yeah,
big
a lot of the acts that came to town, we'd open for them. Yeah.
So were you doing music full-time at that point?
Yeah.
Okay. And so were you working almost every night?
No, we didn't work that much. We worked maybe 2 to 3 weeks a month, you know. We didn't work the whole month, you know, maybe 2 to 3. We, generally about 2 weeks out of a month. Then some lucky, we got 3 weeks out of a month.
Okay.
So we did pretty good.
Did you play anywhere else besides the High Chaparral?
Oh, yeah. We played all the clubs. Burning Spear. We even did some North Side stuff. Remember a club up north called It's Here on Sheridan.
Okay.
Yeah. We played. You wouldn't believe the places we played. We played anywhere you could play, man.
Okay. Yeah. And what did you do all, like, Peaches and Herb, Marvin and Tammy type
No, we
stuff?
Didn't just do all of that. We did other stuff, too. We did some original stuff, and we did Temptations, you know, just everything that was popular in that day, you know.
But were you very Motown-oriented?
Yeah, very. Yeah, Motown was the thing, man.
Okay. Did you do funkier tracks, too?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. What Cool in the Gang, you know.
Okay.
All that funky stuff.
Okay, so how long did Crystal Image, you said it stayed together till 72, something?
Yeah, about 71. Then I went, Joe, the guitar player from Crystal Image, got with this group called Shades of Brown. They were with Chess Records.
Yeah.
And Joe got me a gig with him because our thing kind of played out, and he got me a job driving for them when they went on the road. I'm the driver. And he finagled it and got me to open the show for him after a couple of weeks. And so for about a year, I toured with them opening for the Shades of Brown.
Okay. But you didn't, were you a member? Or you
no, I wasn't a member. Actually,
part of their show.
Yeah, I was just the opening act for their show. But actually, when we came off the road in about 72, we set up the studio. The manager was Bobby Miller.
Bobby Miller, yeah.
He was the same guy who had made the Dells, right. And he had the same envision for the Shades of Brown that he had for the Dells. So he bought this studio and told us, all right, I don't want you guys out on the road anymore. I want you to come in and just write songs, and this is going to be your livelihood. If you come in this place and write songs, you're going to make money. And at that point, the lead singer from the Shades quit. He got married and stayed in Michigan somewhere where we had played. And so Bobby said, why don't you let Doug be the lead singer, take his place, and then you can keep going. But the group didn't really want me. They didn't mind having me opening for them, but they didn't want me to be their lead singer. So they didn't go for it, so they didn't come back to the studio, and they blew it because Bobby had paid for that place, and it became a famous studio called Paul Serrano Studios.
Okay.
323 East 23rd. It was ours.
I didn't know that's how it opened.
That's how it started. Paul Serrano didn't have no money. Bobby Miller gave him the money to hook it up. He paid him to set up the studio.
Because everyone recorded.
Right, Air 25 was in there, man. Yeah. You know, within a year, the place was making over $1 million. But these dummies couldn't see that there was money to be made there. You know, Bobby was producing for Motown. He was with the Four Tops, the Originals, and all these people. He told us, you guys don't have to bust your head on the road no more. Just come here and work. And if you just want to do a show, I'll let you open up for the Four Tops or the Temps or somebody. But they didn't want me in the group, so they just let it go to the wayside. And so Bobby got disgusted and gave the studio to Paul and let Paul pay him off on time. And
so that was a bad career move.
Bad career move. And Paul, it was a great career move for Paul. He's a millionaire now. That studio made big money.
So what did you do after that?
After the Shades, I traveled with the United Cleaning Company. Joe, again, the guitar player, he was always getting gigs. He got a gig with the United Cleaning Company, and I went out on the road with them.
That sounds like a rock group. Were you like a rock group?
Yeah, but they were a funk group.
Okay.
We played the Chitlin' Circuit. And then that group morphed into the James Clark Band, because James Clark was the leader of the United Cleaning Company.
Okay.
So we dropped that name and just took his name. And we kept on touring.
So you were you the lead singer?
Yeah, I was the only singer. You know, I was the front man for that group. I did like Al Green and Otis Redding, all that kind of stuff. And we traveled around the Chitlin' Circuit, and that played out.
How long did you tour with them?
About a year.
Okay.
And after that, I brought a couple of the guys. But Joe was my guy.
Was that the first time you had really toured?
Well, no, I went with the Shades of Brown. I'd been out on the road with them.
Oh, just driving. Oh, yeah, and you were in the
show.
But
I sang with them. Yeah.
Where did you go with them?
We did all of Michigan, all of Wisconsin, some of Minnesota. You know, Chitlin' Circuit gigs, you know, clubs, you know,
okay.
Black clubs. And, okay, so after that, I got into an argument with James Clark because he never paid us. You know, there's always, when it comes time to get paid, always something came up. So I just got tired of that, you know, being broke all of the time. And I confronted him about it. So, James, you need to involve me in business, you know. I need to know see the contracts from now on, you know, if I'm going to stay with you. He refused to let me see contracts, so I quit the group. So when I quit, I told Dean Knox, he was the sax player, and we had another guy, Charles, I don't know Charles' last name, he played trumpet. I said, look, man, I had a group in Chicago before I came out with you guys, so I'm going back and hook my group back up. Why don't you guys come back to Chicago with me and play with us? And they were tired of James, too, being broke, so they came back to Chicago with me after the James Clark Band, and we started Master Plan together.
Okay, well, we've been talking for a while. I'd like to play a song.
Sure.
So the Master Plan... You didn't end up recording until later, so these songs are from a little later. But
much later, yeah. A different version of the group, even.
Yeah, but let me play one of the songs. It's a nice record that never got released called Try It, You'll Like It, and then we can talk some more.
Oh, that was the original group then, yeah. We did that in Minnesota.
Oh, really? Well, then it fits into the story.
Right. It sure does, right.
So this is the Master Plan with...
The original Master Plan.
With Try It, You'll Like It.
Oh,
Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to an interview with a singer named Doug Shorts, who sang in a bunch of groups in Chicago, including his group The Master Plan. So that was just an early, kind of unfinished even recording by The Master Plan. It was a really nice cut. I really like that record. It was called Try It, You'll Like It. So I guess before getting to the recording, who were the original members of the group?
Okay, the original members of the Master Plan were like Dean Knox and Charles. I don't remember Charles' last name, the trumpet player, but that Dean played sax, Charles was trumpet. They were the two guys I brought back off the road. Then I had my original rhythm section. I had Joe Stevenson guitar, Eddie Manning bass, and Kenny Walker drums.
Okay, and were a lot of them from the James Clark?
No, just the guitar player and the two horn players, they came from James Clark Band.
How did you know the other guys?
Which other guys?
The other members of the group, of the Master Plan.
Oh, they were from the original Crystal Image.
Oh, they were from the Crystal
Kenny
Image.
Kenny Walker. And,
okay,
and,
I'm bad with names. Yeah. So you just incorporated more people.
Yeah, we just brought some horn players. I brought some horn players back with me. I went on the road and came back with horn players.
So what year would you say the Master Plan formed?
In 74.
And how did you get the name Master Plan?
Dean Knox from the the James Clark Band, he had that name. He had been in a group or something, or some kind of hookup they had called Master Plan. And I liked the idea. I thought it sounded great for what we were doing, and I used it.
And I actually interviewed a singer from an Oakland group, the Master Plan, around that time. They were recording on D-Li Records, the same label Cool and the Gang was on.
Mm-hmm.
Had you heard of them?
Yes. Not at that point. When we picked up the name, we hadn't heard of them. But later on, we heard the name.
Okay. So the Master Plan, when you originally formed, were you similar to, like, the Crystal Image, just with more members? Like, you did Motown stuff, and were you still playing the High Chaparral a lot?
Actually, we weren't even playing anywhere. Then when we formed Master Plan, we rented a hall on Larrabee Street, became a rehearsal hall, and we started actually doing shows out of our rehearsal hall. And one of the visitors, Daryl, came and seen us rehearsing. He said, man, you guys are ready for the road, man. You should take your show on the road. And so we took it on the road. We went to Detroit, and from Detroit all up into Canada, we ended up in Toronto doing shows.
Okay.
At the Colonial on Yonge Street in Toronto. That was the last gig.
When was that?
That was sometime in 75, 76 or something like that.
Okay, so you initially took the... And what type of material were you doing?
We were doing self-contained stuff like Cool in the Gang, Earth, Wind, and Fire, that type of thing.
But were you the only singer?
Well, no, we all sang then, because while we were Master Plan, before we got the place on Larrabee, we brought Archie Brooks from The Fugitives into the group. He was a singer.
That recorded, right?
Right. Eddie Manning, one of our group members, was one of the original Fugitives.
Okay.
And there was a big feud when Eddie quit The Fugitives and joined us. We almost had to go to fisticuffs with the Fugitives because they didn't want to let him go.
Were The Fugitives from the north side of Chicago?
Yeah, we were all right around the corner from each other. We rehearsed right around the corner.
Okay.
Yeah, we did shows together, too. And like I say, it was a lot of bad blood when Eddie left the group and came with us. And Archie was still in The Fugitives. Eddie talked Archie into coming over with us. And it was really bad blood. So cause we kind of decimated their group to build our group up. And so it was a lot of nonsense happened, but we prevailed, and then I don't know whatever happened to Fugitives, but we kept going.
So at that time you had two singers?
Two singers, yeah, Archie and myself, and we'd take turns doing lead.
And that was Archie Brooks?
Archie Brooks, yeah.
Okay. And so what type of, and you were doing, you said like Cool in the Gang.
Yeah, Archie brought all that. He wanted to do that kind of stuff. He couldn't do it with the Fugitives, so when he got with us, he had freedom to do what he wanted to do, so we did all of the new hip stuff that was happening.
And I know Earth, Wind, and Fire have a ton of harmony. Did the other band members sing backup? A
couple of them, because we changed bass players. We had Greg Poindexter. Yeah, he sang bass. He was from a group called Speed Limit 25.
Okay.
We brought him in, and he sang background. Yeah,
There was a group called the Speed Limits that recorded in Chicago. I don't know if there were.
But these guys are Chicago, too, but they were Speed Limit 25.
I don't know if they're related to the Speed Limit.
I don't know.
So then...
it was the three of us basically did the voices.
Is he still around?
Greg, he's up in Iowa somewhere last time I heard. I don't know what he's doing.
Okay, so then Did that recording that I just played, when was it from?
That was from about, let's see.
The Try It, You Like It.
That was from about 1990 when I was living in Minnesota. No, actually, that had to be way before 1990.
That sounds 70s.
Yeah, it was 70s. That had to be when I was out on the road with the James Clark Band right around that area. We went to Minnesota and the Master Plan. No, wait a minute. When we started Master Plan, when did I say we started Master Plan? 74?
Yeah.
So it had to be about 74. Around sometime in 1974 when we went to Minnesota and we recorded that.
So that Try It, You Like It was the original lineup.
Original lineup, yeah. There's a rhythm section. We didn't have any horns except for Dino and Dean Knox.
And you said that you recorded it in Minnesota?
Yeah.
Where was it, live? Like, what did you do?
No, it was at a recording studio. David Z was at some recording studio. I don't even remember the name of the studio. I just remember David Z because he ended up with Prince later on. He was our engineer. He was a real cool guy.
So you just booked some time? And
yeah, we booked some time in the studio, and we actually overstepped. We didn't have enough money to even pay for the session. You know? So we ended up leaving our master there. I had to go back maybe a couple of months later and pick up our master.
So are you singing lead on that track?
Yeah, that's me. And I wrote that.
And one other voice comes in. Is that Archie, or is that...
That's me. If there's any other voice, it's just me.
Okay, maybe overdub?
Yeah, probably so.
Okay, so the group came back. And how long did that version of the group last?
I know, we lasted a couple of years, and then let me see. Where did I start the next group? Excuse me, I had to look back. My memory is not that good.
But,
original was in 1974, and then we added Rasu and Archie and Joanne. About 1975.
Okay.
So probably about 1975, 1976.
So, and you were still called the Master Plan?
Yeah.
Who were the people you just mentioned? You said Archie Brooks, and who else?
Archie Brooks and Greg Poindexter and Rasul Sadiq. Rasul was a trumpet player.
Okay.
We brought him in, so we had two horns now. And Archie started playing guitar. He took Joe's place. Joe Stevenson used to play guitar. He dropped out on us. And Archie started playing guitar and vocals.
Okay.
Yeah.
And were you working clubs in Chicago? Were you touring? What were you doing?
Yeah, like I said, that's when we had our rehearsal hall. We did our own shows. We produced our own shows there.
So that's what you did most of the time?
Yeah, until we went out on the road.
How many days a month did you put shows on?
Oh, every weekend.
Oh, every weekend you play out your rehearsal.
Right, I had our own little place there on Larrabee Street, right off of North Avenue.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then, and a lot of people come.
Yeah, we had a good following. Yeah.
Okay. And you, like you were saying before, you did Earth, Wind, and Fire. Cool.
Yeah, that's what the stuff we were doing there. And the landlord, seeing that we had a good thing, and he when our lease came up, he wouldn't renew it. So he put us out. So that's when we went on the road. We took off and went to Detroit.
Okay. Was that like 75, 76?
That was about 76, something, yeah.
And so did the group stay together like that throughout the 70s?
Yeah, we stayed in Canada for about a year, and we came back. So about 77, 78, we kind of broke up. We was tired of each other after being together so long.
What did you do in Canada? Just shows?
Shows, yeah, we played.
Okay.
And then about, we were inactive from that point.
Okay.
And the next time I see we...
But I know that your record that you actually released came out in 1980.
Yeah, okay. I was just about to get to that. We were inactive from 79. I worked a regular job. Me and Archie and Greg, we worked at Elaine Bryant at the Big Women's Store. And about 1980 or so, that's when we released a couple of albums. We had that deal with Brunswick, and it fell through. And I also was working at a deal with Motown. The guys who played on one of our records... They were working for Motown, so I went out to visit them, and they got me a contract with Motown. But at the same time I was going to sign with Motown, our group was going to sign with Brunswick. So I was caught in between.
But that was around 1980?
Yeah, around 80. Some.
And you were actually called the Master Plan Incorporated. When did you enter the Incorporated?
I got all of that information in my booth, in my little bag in there. Let me see. I can't tell you right off the top of my head. That stuff is kind of fuzzy.
Yeah, I know it's a long time ago.
Yeah, I would say that we started Master Plan. Well, I know we incorporated the name probably about we started the group in 74, probably about 76, we incorporated the name.
Okay.
And it became a business. That's when we had the little club and everything, the rehearsal hall.
And you were telling me that you incorporated the name with Incorporated as
right.
part of your
name. Right. Oh, yeah, I got a business certificate from an assumed name. Before we incorporated, we were assumed name, you know, because we Archie, myself, and Dean, we went to business school. And we learned how to do business, so we decided we'll go in business. So we started our first business as an assumed name, and we started used the name Master Plan Incorporated. And they actually didn't catch it when we filed the business papers, and we got that name. I still got the certificate, the business certificate, that you're not supposed to get.
Okay.
You're not supposed to have incorporated on a business, on assumed name business. But we did that, but later on, maybe 6-7 months later, we went on and stepped up and became a real corporation, an Illinois corporation.
Okay, so, and you broke up for a couple of years, like 76, 77.
That was pretty much the end of the run.
And then you worked for a little bit, and then you reformed the group?
Yeah, I actually moved to L.A. in 86.
But that was
oh, yeah, before 86, so we did regroup, yeah.
And then you cut this record.
That's when we brought in the Getty Brothers, because, you know, we had a bad experience in Michigan. We were all black group, and we got fired off of a really good job because we were all black. We didn't have any integration.
In the 70s?
Yeah.
Wow.
Right. It was deep, man. Yeah. We got fired off a really good job. And so I felt at that point we needed to put some color in the group, you know, to open it up, make it Technicolor. So that would never happen again. So we got these two Latino brothers, Greg and Rudy Agati, and they are the horn players. And,
okay.
And we hooked them up because Dean had got locked up and went to jail. The sax player that we had before and Rasul went to New York. So we didn't have horns. We were a rhythm section. So we brought in the Agati brothers. And that's when we recorded the stuff with all of the horns. Greg was an arranger, Greg Agati.
Were they in a group before you, do you know?
They played salsa. They played all the salsa groups and stuff. Yeah.
Okay, well, let me play the record you end up recording. I actually want to play the early version of it.
That's the one we recorded at Brunswick, Something to Be Done, the early version.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because it shows off your harmony a little
right,
bit.
Right, yeah.
So let me play Something to Be Done, the earlier version, and then we'll talk about how your record got released.
Okay.
So this is the Master Plan Incorporated from around 1979, 1980. This is an unreleased version of Something to Be Done.
Something to be done.
Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Right now we are in the middle of an interview with a singer named Doug Shorts, who sang with a group called Master Plan, and that was just an early version of the Master Plan's song, which was released like a little bit later. It was called Something to Be Done.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the story with the recording I just played? Where was it recorded?
That was recorded at Brunswick's actual studio on Michigan Avenue, about 18th in Michigan. And we had went in without a contract. We went in on a handshake, and by the time we started recording, everything started changing. The business end of it started changing. And I didn't like where it was going. And when I talked to them and tried to get some clarification, they wouldn't clarify, so we walked out on that session, just dropped it.
And how many songs did you record there, do you remember?
We recorded about 4 songs there.
Who wrote that song?
Archie Brooks wrote that one.
Who were the members of, who was singing and who was playing on that?
That was Archie, myself, and Greg Agetti. And Greg was playing, Archie didn't play. We had Keith Samuels from my previous group played. And we had a guy from New York, Dotto, played Kunga. And Al Brown was our drummer. Greg Poindexter was the bass player.
Okay. And did all 4 songs, did Archie write all 4 songs?
No, we wrote together. Archie's my writing partner.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, I helped him write that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then you ended up, so they never cut any records on that. They just had tape on it and
right.
Walked out.
So we walked out.
So, but you actually did put out a record in 1980, because I have the
right.
Record. It's on a label called Mundo, and one side is Something to Be Done, and the other side is called You.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the story with that record?
Okay, well, after Brunswick screwed us around, we walked down the street and found a friend of ours. Ed Cody had a studio. We went in there and recorded the same song, but we used some other musicians. And Greg's father, Greg Agetti's father, he had aspirations of opening a record label and everything. He had this idea of the Mundo label, and his brother-in-law had wrote a song. It was You, and it was one other song too, Valerie. He had 2 songs he had recorded at Chess, and so we decided we wanted to go on and finish the stuff that we had started at Brunswick. So we combined our efforts. We took Rudy Agetti, that was Greg's dad. We took his 2 songs and combined them with ours. And hired some other musicians and did it at Ed Cody's, and that's how that release came about. We did it ourselves.
Okay, and which I'll play near the end of, like later in the interview,
because
we just played it. So and that came out in 1980. Mm-hmm. So what happened with the record? Did it get any play?
Well, actually, I had to go through the process of trying to see what it takes to get a record played. I actually did the footwork, went to the radio stations, everything, tried to get it played, and found out that we were up against a brick wall. You know, we didn't have a budget to deal with, and it took money to get it done. So I realized it wasn't going to happen, so I just kind of shelved it after a minute.
Were you initially excited because it's the first time you were on vinyl?
Very excited, man. Very excited. And when I actually went up into Johnson's record label, was it JPC, WJPC?
Yeah.
It blew me away, man, to actually be there in the radio station and talking with the program director and getting the dope on getting a record played. And they gave me the 411 on what's happening. And they gave me a lot of insight on how to go about it, but I realized that I couldn't do it without some cash, you know. So I just went back to woodshedding at that point to regroup.
So did the record even get distributed at all, the stores?
No, just the hand distribution that I did, just walked around and put it in a few stores.
So very, very few copies got out.
Very few got out, yeah. I'm surprised that you were able to find a record, even.
I told you I found it at her butler of the Players.
Right. Yeah, well, he was one of our rival groups. Groups that we competed against on the north side, and he had a little success with his group, so he wanted to try to manage my group, and that's how he ended up with the records.
Okay.
So I gave him maybe a box of records or something at that point.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a whole box. What I was saying.
Well, maybe I didn't give him a whole box. But I did give him some copies of the record, though, because he was interested in the group.
Okay. So pretty much the record didn't get played or
no, it didn't get any.
Did the group stay together after that?
Not much longer, because that Brunswick thing kind of broke us apart. You know, like I say, I was Motown was courting me, and I was courting Motown at the same time that we were doing Brunswick. So I was kind of preoccupied with that. And when I closed the deal on the Brunswick, the group kind of blamed me for breaking down their success. They figured we should have made it. And that by me stopping that Brunswick deal, that was our downfall. So I kind of took the villain place again, and that was the end of the group.
Yeah, although by 1980, Brunswick wasn't...
They weren't doing anything. It was a good thing. Actually, a guy that was involved in that deal came to me. I saw him a couple of years later and said, man, you were the smartest guy in the room. Because they were out to get you.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the biggest thing they put out. It was probably Von Bounce.
Yeah, somebody.
Von Mason.
Yeah, right. And that didn't do really great. Yeah.
So they weren't really a big
label. They weren't doing anything anymore. And I didn't hear of anything coming out of that. So it was a good move we made to not sign with them.
So did you continue to do music after that?
Very little. I kind of just went into work. I became a security expert doing security for a lot of different companies.
Okay.
But I still kept writing. You know, I kept some recording equipment at home, and I would write. And later on, like, I moved out to Los Angeles, and I did a cassette. I released a cassette, and I did a CD of gospel music.
Okay. And I see the cassette. You brought it here. It's got a nice color. It's from 86, I think.
Yeah.
So you were living in L.A. around 86?
Yeah.
How long did you live in Los Angeles?
From 86 to 2003.
Oh, so you were there for a long time.
Yeah, good little piece.
And you were doing music kind of as a hobby?
Yeah, basically. I maybe did one show the whole time I was in L.A. I did some recordings, though.
So did you have a band?
No.
Okay.
I was just a regular working stiff in L.A.
Okay. And you came back to Chicago 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And have you done music since then?
No, not really. Just recordings. That's all. I've been just recording.
What type of stuff are you recording?
Funk. I'm a funk master.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be cool to hear some of it. You brought a CD, but it won't play on
the... Yeah, and I brought some house music, too. I did some step-in music. I got a step-in album I want to release.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, the CD players here are kind of...
But I got that gospel thing. You could play one of those. I got a little play with that Try God. That's the only royalty money I ever made.
Okay. Andrew was telling me he liked one of the tracks.
Where's Your Faith?
Can I play that one?
Sure.
Okay. This is just released as Doug Shorts. When is this from? Let me see if there's a date on the CD. There's no date on the CD.
2002.
Okay. It's called Where's Your Faith, and then we'll talk a little bit more. So this is a gospel track by Doug Shorts called Where's Your Faith. Tell me who makes the rain.
how did you start to breathe? Do you believe in miracles or only what you see? Can't you feel it in your spirit? Are you pure of heart? If your faith sustains you, you should be giving thanks to God.
Okay, that was just Doug Shorts doing a really nice gospel track called Where Is Your Faith? And when did that come out?
In 2002.
And it's on a CD. Who plays on that?
That's quite a few guys. Myself, Roosevelt, Purified, Melvin Robinson, Calvin Brunson, Jeremiah, Africa, and Archie Brooks, my writing partner.
So the whole time you've stayed with Archie Brooks
making
music?
Oh, yeah, we've been
music.
Together since we were kids, man.
So, and this is a CD you put out yourself?
Yeah, well, I was living in L.A.
Okay, so this came out in L.A.
Yeah.
How did Archie come out to L.A. to do it?
No, I came back here and we did some tracks.
Okay, and what have you been doing since that CD?
Working.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you've been back in Chicago. And
yeah,
I came back
to be with my mom. Yeah, I got a studio built in my mom's basement.
Okay.
And so I've been just in there doing my own thing, stockpiling tunes, what have you.
Okay. So, it's too bad, like, the CD's not working because I'd like to play some of the new stuff.
Maybe do it again sometime. I come bring you something to listen to.
And there's a song, I have a short, incomplete version of it called For the Brothers. What's the story behind this song?
Well, that's one of the tunes we did at Brunswick where we walked out at, and we didn't never really get to master. We re-recorded it down the street at Ed's later on.
Okay. So this short clip, it would be a version
at Brunswick. That's when the original version when we recorded at Brunswick.
Can we play this and we could talk a little bit more?
Sure.
So this is the Master Plan Incorporated from around 1980. This track is called For the Brothers.
Dying by the dozen, hey, the touch of
Okay, you're tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. That was just the Master Plan Incorporated from around 1980, recorded at the Brunswick Studios. That track was called For the Brothers, and it was an excellent record. It was too bad that it never got officially released, but still nice.
It's going to get released, though, because I'm working on it now. I got a new track of that particular tune.
And you were saying it's still relevant today?
Very relevant.
Okay.
There's always somebody's dying. And your uncles and cousins, brothers, you know, fathers, mothers, brothers, everybody's dying. And so it's always going to be relevant.
And so today you're still making music. You're living in Chicago and making music. You have your own studio in a basement. So then you plan to put out a new version of
For the Brothers, yes, absolutely. I got two albums ready to go, man. Actually, I got some stuff on YouTube now, just trying to get a feel for what's happening. But I got an album called Chicago Basement Stepping, with a lot of stepping music. Then I got another one called Welcome to Funkland for all the funk people.
And what type of funk sound? What does it sound like?
I don't know who I could say it sounds like. I'd like to say it sounds like Doug Short.
Okay.
It's funky. Let me just leave it at that. It's funk.
And one thing I forgot to ask, so first of all, people could go to YouTube and type in Doug Shorts. And
right, they'd come up with a video or some songs or something, yeah.
And one thing that I forgot to ask you, I'm sorry about this, I forgot to ask you about your time at Jerry Butler's Writer's Workshop.
So, oh, it was a great time. I learned a lot working with Jerry Butler, man. He put me with Calvin Carter, the legendary producer, and I was too young to understand the opportunity, and I didn't want to work with Calvin. I just hated it.
Why did you hate it?
Because Calvin was a blues man. You know, I hated the blues at that point. I was like maybe 20 years old, and I was into Hendrix and all of the progressive new stuff. And he wanted to take me back to Little Milton, you know, Grits and Groceries and all that. And I just, we didn't mesh, you know.
So what years were you in the Writer's Workshop?
Did you blow my mind on that.
The early 70s?
Yeah, it was around the same time Master Plan we started. Around 75, somewhere around there, 76.
So
no, wait a minute. No, it had to be 68, 69.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
So can you talk about what the workshop was and what...
It was a great place, man. We had a lot of great writers, man. Everybody was there. That's where Chuck Jackson and Marvin Yancey hooked up and did all the Natalie Cole stuff. I was contracted to do Oscar Brown Jr., but again, here I was too young to be dealing with these old guys, and I didn't like it, so I didn't do it. So I kind of shot myself in the foot on a couple occasions. I wouldn't work with Calvin. I wouldn't work with Oscar Brown Jr., because basically I didn't know who these people were.
So it was pretty much just like, well, where was it also?
It was on Michigan Avenue, 18th in Michigan, right across from Brunswick, actually.
So it was a place where songwriters got together.
Yeah, Jerry got a contract from Stax Records, I think. They gave him the money to bring in writers off the street and pay them a stripping to stay there and write songs and produce.
Okay, so you were writing for all sorts of different artists as part of this workshop.
Yeah, everybody did. We collaborated. It's just like Motown's The Corporation. It was modeled after that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you remember some of the other local people you
wrote? Chuck Jackson, Jesse Jackson's younger brother. He had a group called The Independents.
Yeah.
He had a cartoon, Leaving Me. That was a product of the workshop.
Okay.
Let me see, who else? Johnny Jones, he was from my neighborhood. I forget the name of the tune they did. He had did a tune with a guy named James Blumenberg. And Billy Butler, Jerry's brother, they did a thing, The Infinity.
Okay.
Stay on the Case.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was part of all of that.
Okay, but you probably learned a lot.
Learned a ton. A lot of great musicians came through there. I learned licks, you know, learning to play. Cause I was learning to play bass at the time I was there. And I played bass on a lot of demos up there.
Okay. So, finally, first of all, I want to thank you for coming down and telling your story.
My pleasure, man. I'm loving it.
Yeah, like, you have like a... Like, even though only one piece of vinyl ever got released, you cut a lot of excellent material and you have a lot of interesting stories because you worked with so many people and were part of so much history in Chicago over the years. So thanks so much for coming down.
Thank you for having me.
And do you have any last words for the listening audience?
Well, just love Chicago. We were once on top of the thing. Maybe we'll get back one day.
I hope so. Chi-town is...
Chi-town, baby.
Okay, well, thanks again. And this last record I'm going to play is The one thing that was actually released, this is the released version from 1980 of the Master Plan Incorporated doing Something to Be Done.
Laying down, got to get my feet.